At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only 10 bucks every day. Now that's finger-lickin' good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.
Mornings can start feeling the same. Wake up, brush teeth, go to work. But with breakfast from Wendy's, it's like, wake up, brush teeth, baconate with a breakfast baconator, roll with the sausage breakfast burrito, buddy it up with a honey buddy, or get seasoned with seasoned potatoes, and then go to work. Sorry. When you're ready for a fresh wake-up call, gotta be Wendy's.
At participating U.S. Wendy's during breakfast hours.
Due to the themes of this podcast, listener discretion is advised. Lock your doors. Close the blinds. Change your passwords. This is Secrets and Spies. Secrets and Spies is a podcast that dives into the world of espionage, terrorism, geopolitics, and intrigue. This podcast is produced and hosted by Chris Carr.
Hello everybody, it's Chris here. As you may have heard, there's a new James Bond film coming out called No Time to Die. I'm due to see it myself on Thursday and I'm looking forward to it. It struck me that it might be a good idea to have a special episode on Ian Fleming. So, today I'm joined by author Mark Simmons and we discuss his book, Ian Fleming's War. I hope you enjoyed this episode. And just a quick note, our next episode will be out on the 5th of November. Take care.
The opinions expressed by guests on Secrets and Spies do not necessarily represent those of the producers and sponsors of this podcast.
Mark, welcome to the podcast.
Hello, thank you for having me on.
It's great to have you on. Please, can you just tell us a little bit about yourself and your past work?
Right, I was brought up in the West Country mainly. Mm-hmm. Dad was in the Navy, so we did have periods where we lived in Scotland and Malta. Yeah. In the 1970s, or most of the 1970s, I was in the Royal Marine Commandos. I started writing, I suppose, in the 1980s. I wrote mainly articles then on military history, travel, motoring, that sort of thing. And my first book was published in 2004. And I've had 13 since then, I think. I'm working on number 14 at the moment.
Ah, cool. Can you tell us what number 14 is about, or is it top secret at the moment?
No, it's not a top secret. It is Alistair MacLean's War.
Ah, Alistair MacLean. Yeah, very interesting writer. Excellent. Yeah. Excellent.
Which should be out next year.
Oh, fantastic. Well, I'll keep an eye out for that. So you're joining me today because you've written this fantastic book called Ian Fleming's War that kind of goes into some of the real-life intelligence experience Ian Fleming had that informed his later James Bond novels. So I suppose my first question about the book is sort of what was it that inspired you to write this book?
Oh, well, that's quite an easy answer to that one. It was the previous book. Mm. Which was Ian Fleming and Operation GoldenEye, keeping Spain out of World War II.
Yeah.
That was where I really came across. Well, I knew about Ian Fleming before that, obviously, but I really delved into him a bit there, although he isn't the sole character in that book. There's a lot of other people in it as well.
Yeah.
But it did strike me as I was researching Fleming. I read the two main biographies by Andrew Lycett and John Pearson. And it struck me that one devoted two chapters to his career in naval intelligence and the other one chapter. And I thought, well, there's a big gap here, so
yeah.
That was what inspired me to write Ian Fleming's War, which just concentrates really on those 6 years of his life and how it influenced, of course, his writing.
Yeah, definitely. So how did you kind of go about researching the books? You've mentioned the sort of biographies, because there are quite a few books on Fleming. But what was it, how did you kind of go about diving into the sort of records and all that kind of stuff?
Well, the wife and I went to Kew.
Yeah.
The National Archives, and spent quite a bit of time there delving through the Naval Intelligence records. Also, the Imperial War Museum, I came across some eyewitness accounts of people who had served with Fleming, which I don't think anybody had really explored before to any great depth. And those two real sources provided the core of the book. Of course, I reread all the James Bond books, which was quite a pleasure, actually, because I think they stand the test of time very well, actually, the original books.
Yeah, then they're fantastic books. Do you, may I ask, do you have a favourite James Bond book?
Oh, yeah, From Russia With Love, I think.
Yeah, yeah, that one and On Her Majesty's Secret Service are definitely my favourites. I think they're great books.
Yeah,
no, fantastic. Well, can you paint us a little bit of a picture of sort of Ian Fleming's life just before the war, before he joined Naval Intelligence?
Yes, well, he was, you might say, a bit of a failure, might be a too harsh a word, but he wasn't a very happy person before the war, I don't think myself. He had, much to his family's chagrin, he failed at Sandhurst. He'd had to leave, well, resign, he did. He failed the Foreign Office exam, which he was expected to pass. Then he went to Reuters, and he quite enjoyed that as a correspondent. He started off writing articles about motor racing, actually, because he, as we know, he was a bit of a petrol head, as was Bond.
Yeah.
And he even went on some rallies with Donald Healey, who of course, started the Austin Healey cars. And he became a lifelong friend. He was sort of the co-pilot in the Monte Carlo rally and Alpine rallies and things like that. And he was quite enjoying that, but it didn't pay very well, and his lifestyle was sort of supplemented by allowances from his family. Well, come the end, they sort of read him the riot act that he had to stand on his own 2 feet. Like, but they got him a job as a merchant banker, which he stockbroker, which he didn't. He hated, actually. And that was what he was doing when he got the call from Naval Intelligence. But he didn't like the job, and he was a bit of a rake. He spent the money as quickly as he earned it. Right? You know, he was living, even then he was living beyond his means as such. So he wasn't a very happy person at the start of it, well, just before the war started.
Yeah, no, I got the impression that in many respects, Ian Fleming, the war itself was actually probably the making of him. I don't know if that's a fair assessment, but it certainly felt that way.
Oh, absolutely. I think that's correct, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Well, can you talk to us about how Ian Fleming ended up in working for Naval Intelligence during the war?
Well, Admiral Godfrey took over as the director of Naval Intelligence about 6 or 7 months before the war started. He'd been on the fringes of Naval Intelligence, but it was a new job to him. So he sought the advice of Reginald Blinker Hall, been the director of Naval Intelligence in the First World War, a very successful director. And with varied discussions with him, he emphasized the point that Godfrey should not only have naval officers in his department, but a lot of civilians as well.
Yeah.
So as they would think outside the box, as they term it. And Hall had a stockbroker as his private secretary in the First World War. And so Godfrey knew some people in the banking sector, and he approached them, and they suggested Fleming. So he met him a couple of times, and eventually he was employed at Naval Intelligence. If he hadn't have been, he was down to be a reserve officer in the Black Watch. So he would have ended up in the Black Watch if Admiral Godfrey hadn't come along. So he started part-time afternoons. Mm. That was before the war actually broke out. And come the end of that, Godfrey made a comment that very often he felt like he was the secretary and Fleming was the director. That's it. But he was a real ideas man, that's what Fleming was, you know.
Mm.
Some of them were absolutely crazy, but others were very good, you know.
Yeah, yeah. He had I can't remember if I read it in your book, but somebody said he had something like a 6-to-1 ratio of ideas or something.
So, that's right, about that. Yeah,
yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, fantastic. And he was, I think, if I remember correctly, Fleming himself was inspired by a lot of sort of fiction, like Bulldog Drummond and things like that.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And The Riddle of the Sands, that sort of thing, yeah.
Yeah.
John Buchan.
That's it. Yeah, no, fantastic. And Ian Fleming as well had a couple of brothers who were in the war. Was it Michael and obviously Peter? And they were kind of, because I got the impression Ian was a bit, he had itchy feet when a naval intelligence sort of behind a desk. And obviously his brothers were out there kind of in the action. And I think obviously the social pressures of that time as well were probably playing on his mind.
Yeah. Of course, Michael was killed in the war.
Yeah, yeah.
Peter, he worked in more in the intelligence in the field, out in the Far East and India a lot, yeah.
Also, I think, Ian was sort of a little bit in the shadow of his father growing up, wasn't he?
Well, his father was killed in the First War.
Mm.
So he was largely brought up by his mother, who was a bit of a domineering character. I suppose they had this image of their father, you know, the hero that had died in the First World War.
Mm. No, it's interesting. Well, look, your book does a fantastic job of going into detail many of the operations Ian Fleming was a part of. And sadly, we won't be able to go through all of them, but it's more reason why people should get your book. But I'd love to discuss a few of them. And one that popped out straight away was Operation Goldeneye, which Ian Fleming named his house after in Jamaica. Can you talk to us about Operation Goldeneye?
Yeah, Operation Goldeneye was a stay-behind operation if the Germans had moved into Spain and Portugal.
Mm.
By that, I mean there would be sabotage teams that would blow up railways and bridges, that sort of thing. And it was subdivided into two operations. Operation Sprinkle, I think if memory serves right, was if the Germans had been invited into Spain. As we know, Franco was a fascist, and he had been supported by Hitler and Mussolini during the Spanish Civil War. So there was a lot of people thought that Franco would align with Hitler. And then there was Operation Sconce. That was if the Germans invaded Spain. That was the Spanish didn't invite them in. And a lot of teams were trained in Scotland by the SOE. Mostly Spanish people, ready for this. Of course, this was, it was only put on alert twice, I think, during the war, because, of course, the Germans didn't move into Spain. But it was hatched by Ian Fleming, who was sent out to Spain shortly after France fell.
Mm.
And Alan Hillgarth, who was the naval attache in Madrid, they cooked up this idea of the stay-behind teams. And then Ian Fleming actually came up with the name, Goldeneye, for the operation. But, of course, it was never implemented. But it was the closest Fleming got to being a secret agent, because he went out there in civilian clothes. He took this pen with cyanide in it and a commando knife and all this with him, you know.
He was playing
the role as such, you know.
So you can see why the name was close to his heart with naming the house.
Yeah, absolutely.
There's another operation he was involved with called Operation Ruthless, which some of those details appear in Thunderball, which in the novel.
That's right, Thunderball. Ruthless was, that was about 1940. That was during the, this was during the Battle of Britain and the start of the Blitz, so to speak. The Navy were very keen to get hold of some German naval code books. And Fleming came up with this idea that there have been reports that fast German launches were going into the channel to pick up downed Luftwaffe pilots who had crashed into the sea, and they were going out to pick them up. So Fleming came up with this idea that they had a captured German Heinkel bomber that they would send out at the end of a raid as if it was in distress, crash it into the sea with a British crew on board that would all be German speakers, and they'd wait for this rescue launch to come up, and then they'd overpower the crew and take the launch back to the UK with the code books. This was the idea. And it was all ready to go, actually. But Fleming wanted to go himself, but Godfrey wouldn't let him. And the crew was ready to go and everything. But on the two raids that the Germans had on the Portsmouth area, because that's where the aircraft was, there was no reports of launches coming out. So it never went off. But, of course, crashing into the sea is the Thunderball, where the Spectre capture this British bomber and crash it into the sea, which has got atomic bombs on it. We've all seen the film or read the book.
Yeah.
And that's where the idea came from. And also, they have the Disco Volante, where they take the bombs off the crashed aircraft into the Disco Volante, and of course that came which had a false bottom that opens up. That came from the when he came across the Italian commandos in Gibraltar that were using a ship with a false under the water line, where their frogmen came out into Gibraltar and attached limpet mines to ships in Gibraltar, who were very successful, the ex-mass, the Italian commandos. They in Alexandria harbour, they sank two British battleships. We were very lucky that it was quite shallow water, so they just rested on the bottom. And they could be refloated eventually, but they were put out of action for about 6 months, these two battleships.
Yeah. I always find, looking back on the war, because we know the ending, it's kind of, I don't know if it's presented as a bit more coherent and people are kind of cooperating more, but when you look into the history of the war, it just seems a lot more dysfunctional than it appears in the films.
You're probably right.
No, I'm always surprised, especially about the 1940, because there was the very real impression that the Germans might invade Britain. It was, and I didn't realise sort of how close it felt, but it's fascinating.
Yeah, I don't think it was as close in reality as what people thought, actually, but there we are.
I know there's a lot of elements that would make that hard logistically, definitely. Well, there's a very interesting operation about luring a senior Nazi official, Rudolf Hess, to the UK in 1941. Can you talk to us about this interesting chapter?
I don't think that Fleming was actually that involved in it. A lot of people have suggested he was. That's why I wrote the chapter on it. Especially Knight, the director of MI5, suggested that he and Fleming cooked this idea up, but I would question that, really. That he ever had much to do with it, other than Aleister Crowley, the occultist, did write a letter to Admiral Godfrey offering his assistance when Hess had arrived, that was, because Hess was a bit obsessed with the occult, as they say Hitler was, you know, so... there's been an awful lot written about it, but I don't think that really Fleming was that involved. A lot of people point towards Ian Fleming being involved because Peter Fleming wrote a book, The Visit, I think it's called, where Hitler comes over Britain to gloat how the Luftwaffe were destroying all the cities, and the plane he comes over and crashes. And he tries to reveal himself to the British, and nobody will believe him who he is. And eventually they send him back in another plane.
Yeah. He has this sort of weird little adventure, doesn't he? He ends up sort of befriending locals and, yeah.
Tongue-in-cheek comedy thing. But the strange thing about it, he wrote it about 6 months before Hess arrived.
Yeah.
So a lot of people think that's how Ian Fleming was involved, but I don't think he ever was, really. Other than he did go and see Crowley down in Torquay.
Mm.
And I think Fleming was a bit interested in the occult as well. So.
Yeah. Well, Crowley, I believe, is the inspiration for Le Chiffre in the novel.
That's right, That's the big inspiration he was, in Casino Royale,
Because a lot of people talk about Ian Fleming's connection of helping create the CIA. There's even a scene in the TV show Fleming, which was made about 10 years ago, I think, where he's meeting with senior American intelligence officials in the OSS, and then he writes this sort of memo overnight that kind of provides a blueprint for a central intelligence agency. Can you talk to us a bit about this period?
I think it was a bit more than a memo. He was locked in a room. Well, they say he was locked in, but he was in a room for several days, apparently. Mm. It ran to 70 pages.
Oh, wow.
He did it for Donovan, who had become the head of the OSS. Of course, Edgar Hoover, the head of the FBI, was against any other organization being formed. So there was a lot of infighting in the States about this. A lot of people pour cold water on this, but it is revealing that Donovan gave Fleming an inscribed revolver.
Yes.
Order for services rendered, written on it, or something like that.
Yeah, it's a cult police positive. I think I saw it. Yeah. There was a brilliant exhibition in 2008 at the Imperial War Museum, and it was sort of like Ian Fleming's personal items, and there was all sorts of things from a cult python, which was revolved from the 50s, and there was the police positive, which was the one Donovan gave him. Great stuff.
So I think he did have some influence on the start of the OSS, which of course later became the CIA.
And Fleming had interesting connections with William Stevenson, who was the head of the BSC. I don't know if there's any thoughts you have on that at all, because that's a really interesting area.
He was a great admirer of William Stevenson. And of course, he went on this raid of the Japanese embassy in New York. Fleming considered Stevenson to be a real spy, you know, whereas he was more of an office man, really.
That raid he fictionalizes in the opening of Casino Royale. How Bond gets his 00 status.
That's right. That's another piece he used.
One other big thing that comes up often with Ian Fleming is the creation of 30 Assault Unit, which I think some people called Ian's Red Indians. I don't know if you could tell us a little about that sort of area.
That was they formed this assault unit, which was mainly Royal Marine Commandos and naval officers, did have occasionally people from other branches of the services operating with it.
Mm.
The main role was when they went in on a landing, they would go in with the almost with the assault troops. And the idea was to capture any intelligence they could, code machines, documents, anything they could find, which, and it was a very successful, not so much in the first operations they went on, but in Sicily, on the landings in Sicily, they captured fairly early the German codes for radar direction of their fighters, which they immediately got to the RAF, which made a big difference to their bombing raids, that they could block the German radar signals to their fighters. So things that they also did that in Holland. They managed to get the radar codes for the entire European sector from the Germans, and they could block their radar completely until, obviously, the Germans would get wise to it, and then they'd change the code. But, you know, it gave them an advantage for a few weeks, probably, you know, which was quite an achievement, really.
Yeah, definitely.
And all sorts of things they found. You know, code machines were quite common. They, towards the end of the war, they even managed to get hold of the entire German naval records in a castle in Germany. That was when Germany was collapsing, really. But it was quite an achievement, because where this castle was, Fleming actually went on that, because he called it Dracula's Castle. Yeah, he went there for 3 days to see this library of all the documents. And he got them shipped back to the UK. They got a trawler out there, because there were virtually tons of these documents, the entire German naval records, which was quite an achievement. That was at the very end of the war.
Yeah, so was it as tactically helpful? I don't know, but it's fascinating, isn't it?
No, not so much tactically helpful, I suppose, for the future, really, because there was a lot of the Germans were quite advanced on their U-boats at the end of the war. And we got a lot of the information on that.
And I know the Germans frequently shared tactics with the Japanese, and I believe even the Pearl Harbor raid may have been based on, I think it might have been the British raid on Mers El Kabir, but I could be wrong, but there's certainly...
The raid on Taranto.
Oh, was it?
We attacked the Italian fleet at Taranto with aircraft. Yeah, and then we sank two or three battleships. Yeah, the Japanese would have been well aware of the raid on Taranto.
Yeah, so all that kind of information is very useful.
Yeah.
One thing I'd like to just quickly talk about a bit more is Ian Fleming's relationship with Admiral John Godfrey, because some sort of have painted him as a bit of a father figure to Ian Fleming. I don't know if you have any thoughts on that.
Yeah, I suppose he was, in a way. He was certainly a big influence on Fleming. Of course, he was only there for about the first 3 years. He got the sack eventually because he rubbed people up the wrong way. He was a bit of an abrasive figure, and Churchill wasn't all that fond of him. And I think there was a bit of a feeling that people were out to cut him down to size, because what happened was Admiral Cunningham was the commander-in-chief in the Mediterranean. So naval intelligence were able to share all their intelligence with the commander-in-chief. So he shared it with Cunningham. Well, then Cunningham was sent to Washington as the naval liaison with the Americans. And he kept on sharing all the intelligence with Cunningham. But he wasn't the commander-in-chief then. So that's what they got. They said, you shouldn't be doing this. And that's, and the Admiralty wouldn't support Godfrey, and that's how he got the sack,
basically.
But it was only a technicality, really.
But they may have been looking for them,
And of course, I forget the name of the chap that took over.
Edmund Rushbrook, yeah.
That's right.
Yeah, Admiral.
He took over. But he didn't really want the job. And a lot of people say that when he took over, it was Fleming that actually held the whole thing together, really.
Wow. Yeah, what was that transition like for Fleming? So that must have been, in some ways, quite sad because Godfrey's going, but as you're painting a picture of him, he gets the rule of the roost, so to speak, it might have been quite positive for him too.
I suspect he had mixed emotions on that, but there was so much going on that I suppose you had to get on with it. Like, you know. He certainly used Godfrey as the blueprint for M in the books, no doubt about that. Because you even have Repulse mentioned, which was Godfrey's last seagoing command, was the battle cruiser Repulse, which was sunk by the Japanese off Malaya in 1941. But that was is often mentioned in, I think, two of the Bond books. It's mentioned Repulse. He doesn't even change the name of the ship, you know. So
he obviously had a big. Big admiration for him. I know, I think I've read Godfrey even commented on it years later, saying something on the lines of he hopes he wasn't and wasn't based on him, but
I think it was largely, yeah.
Definitely.
There were one or two other people that they suggested, like Knight of MI5 might have been, and Stuart Menzies, the director of MI6, I think it's mainly Godfrey.
Yeah, definitely. Well, as the war ended, Ian Fleming did have the possibility to sort of remain in intelligence. I think he even had a potential to go and join MI6, but he chose not to. So can you talk to us a little bit about his later life and what led up to writing his obviously famous novel Casino Royale?
Well, he, as you say, he had the opportunity, but he decided against it because he thought the peacetime intelligence might be too boring. So he had an offer to go and be the foreign correspondent of the Times, the director of foreign correspondence. So he took that up, and because before the war, that had been the job he'd enjoyed most when he was a correspondent. So that's what he did immediately after the war.
Yeah. And
he had a friend, Ivor Bryce, who he got to find a plot on Jamaica. And a part of his contract with the Times was he got 2 months of the year off, which January and February, which he went to Jamaica then. And Bryce got him this plot on Jamaica where he built GoldenEye, the bungalow. And he used to go there, sail across the Atlantic on one of the Queens and then take the train from New York to Florida and fly from Florida to Jamaica. That's how you had to do it at that time, just at the end of the war, 1940s to 50s. And he got married, actually, to Anne Rothermore. That wasn't her maiden name, because she had been married a couple of times before. And they got married, and she says that he wrote Casino Royale because he got married. But
yes.
I don't know about that. But anyway, it was at that time he did write it, in 1952. Mm. They say he wrote it in about 6 weeks.
Mm.
And it was in this 2 month leave he used to have. And after Casino Royale, while he was at the Times, he remained at the Times for a while, and he used to, in this 2 months leave, he used to write another book. And, of course, Casino Royale came out of his time at Estoril and in Portugal, and with his time in Spain as well. Although he set it in France, it was based on those times in Estoril. Which Popoff, the double agent, in his book, he says Fleming was watching him when he bet $30,000 on the turn of a card.
Yeah.
In the Estoril Casino, and he says he based Casino Royale on that, you know. And Popoff was supposed to be Bond, you know.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, fantastic.
Popov was a Yugoslavian. He was a double agent. Yeah.
Yeah, Dusko Popov. Yeah, fascinating, yeah. Character. Yeah, yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
Well, one of my last questions really is, obviously there's a lot of speculation about who James Bond's based on, and obviously I don't think there's a single person, but what are your thoughts on who the character of James Bond could be based on?
Well, it's mostly Fleming himself, obviously. Mm. Popov might have been... Commander Crabb, Lionel Crabb.
Oh, yeah, yeah, fascinating figure.
I rather like him because, of course, Fleming was keen on diving. In fact, when Casino Royale came out, he missed the launch because he was diving with Jack Cousteau. And he was very keen on diving. And, of course, the Lionel Crabb business about how he died when he went there. Was sent, he was too old at the time. He was sent to dive under a Russian cruiser that was visiting Portsmouth, which was a MI6 operation, which was completely bungled. And of course, he died, and his body was found a few months later. But yeah.
Well, he's. Do you know what's interesting? Actually, I mean, again, pure speculation. But Lionel Crabb's handler was also the man who went to interview Kim Philby in Beirut and possibly let Kim Philby go.
Yeah, that's right. He wasn't very good, actually.
No, so poor old Lionel Crabbs was sort of doomed, really, being assigned to that guy.
Yeah. And then there was his friend Peter Smithers. He was very fond of him, and there might be elements of the Bond character from Peter Smithers. Mm. He was the naval attache in Mexico.
Yeah. Yeah. And I know some people have mentioned Sidney Reilly, Ace of Spies. I don't know if any thoughts.
Oh, yeah, that's another one.
Yeah.
I think that's going back a bit too far, really.
Yeah. Yeah. I think, was Fleming reading about him in the files or something, I believe. But
yeah, probably, yeah.
Well... Mark, thank you for all of that today. Where can listeners find out more about you and your excellent book?
Well, I've got an author's page on Amazon, and I'm on Facebook. They can contact me on Facebook. I've got a writer's page on Facebook, but I also have got a... we do some book fairs in the Southwest.
Yeah.
So they can always meet me in a book fair, and there's a book fair page on Facebook as well.
Excellent, excellent. So they should put in Mark Simmons to Facebook and Mark Simmons to Amazon, yeah?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, brilliant, brilliant. Well, that's it. That's Ian Fleming's War. So, Mark, thank you so much for joining me today. And it's been great to have you on. So thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for listening. This is Secrets and Spies.
Shop the Sherwin-Williams Labor Day sale and get 35% off paints and stains August 22nd through September 4th. With prices starting at $31.84, it's the perfect time to transform your space with color. Whether you're looking to revamp your interior or exterior, we have you covered with bold hues, soothing neutrals, and everything in between. Visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store or shop the sale online. Delivery available on qualifying orders. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only. Some exclusions apply. See store for details.
Lowe's has the Labor Day deals you need to give your home a new look. Buy one, get one free select interior paint via Visa gift card rebate. Then add the final touch with 2 for $8 on select 2.5 or 3-quart mums. Refresh your home and save big while doing it. Lowe's. We help. You save. Valid through 9-3. Mums offer in-store only. Selection varies by location. While supplies last. More terms and restrictions apply. See Lowe's.com/rebates for details.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.